Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest episode, the latest edition, latest chapter of Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, but of course, the star of the show, as ever, the wonderful, the, I would say, excitable, because she gets very excitable sometimes. Yeah,
nice.
Look, she's getting excited now. I haven't even introduced her. Ms. Leslie Ann Jones, the rock chick extraordinaire. And I think you've got something to celebrate today, Leslie Ann, haven't you? Because you spend most of your life hunched over a desk, knocking out words, but you may be able to take a bit of a break now, I understand, for the next couple of days.
I handed it in. The latest has gone
what
to
you
my...
hand in? You notice?
yeah, to myself, because I'm self-employed. Yes. No, to my editor and publisher, my wonderful editor and publisher. She is now in receipt of my latest book. And what a relief. I sat for over 10 hours yesterday trying to nail that last chapter, because I always leave the final chapter until the end, obviously till the end, but I have to then read the whole thing through that I've done already so that I can... so that I can shape the final chapter properly and give the reader a satisfying conclusion.
A satisfying conclusion, indeed, is what we're all looking for in life, isn't it?
It's a family show.
It's a family show, yeah. I'm still searching for a final conclusion, believe me. Anyway, listen, we've got a bit to talk about in Fleet Street this week. People like our Fleet Street stories because it's a sort of, you know, a demonstration of the life we've led, and we've all met some very interesting characters. One interesting character we both met, but I think you knew her better than me, was a lady called Bridget Rowe, who at 70 years of age has sadly succumbed, it appears, from COVID-19. Bridget, I knew her as editor of the Sunday People. She was another one of those women, wasn't she, Leslie Ann, who actually smashed through a bit of the male domination of the male sort of glass ceiling of Fleet Street.
She definitely did. When I first knew her, she was editing Woman's Own, which is one of those weekly magazines. Yep. A lot of us journalists cut our teeth on Woman's Own, and she was very much a champion of our cause. And she'd been on The Sun, I think, and she'd gone into IPC magazines with the intention of going back to Fleet Street, which she very successfully did, working on the Sunday Mirror. She launched Sunday Magazine at the News of the World and obviously edited The People as well, as you say. Yes. And she had our backs. She didn't stand for any nonsense where editors would favour, for example, male reporters on a particular kind of job. Mm. If it was a case of going into Wormwood Scrubs and somebody might say, we can't send Leslie Ann on a job like that, she'll be eaten alive. She'd say, well, I don't see why not. You know, actually, she might get a better story. So she was always up for pushing women and equalising, balancing the office floor. And I really admired her for that.
Yeah, no, I met her a few times. Always very lively, but you can spot these women a mile off, and you're amongst them. You know, they don't care about the male prejudice in Fleet Street. You know, there's you, there's Wendy Henry, Bridget Rowe, Eve Pollard. You just kind of get on with it and forge your own careers. And I have a huge admiration for that generation of women. You're much younger than the ones I've just mentioned for just getting on with it. But you know, I do appreciate that. You know, there was terrible prejudice against women and terrible behaviour by men in those years in Fleet Street. I really do.
Yeah, there really was. And it was because of women like Bridget, who you've mentioned, Eve Pollard, other women like that, of that ilk. It was because of them that the next generation down, if you like, people like me, were able to break through and come forward and be successful.
No, I totally agree.
Profession.
You know, when you think now today, The Sun is edited by a woman called Victoria Newton, I think, isn't it? I mean, how could you have imagined that 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, to be honest? But anyway, there we are. Listen, going from that from Fleet Street, of course, we covered some amazing stories during our lifetime. Did you ever come across a legend, but a twisted and evil legend called Phil Spector?
No, I never met him. It's interesting, the criticism that's come out over the last couple of days.
Indeed.
because of the obituaries and so on.
The way he was sort of introduced to his obituary, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, obviously a very complicated person, a convicted murderer, and yet he created some of the most important pop music of the 20th century and worked with the Beatles and created the Wall of Sound, which was a style of music that so many musicians and producers have followed since.
Well, I mean, what was that? Was that just layer of music over music over music, so to speak?
Well, he would just get complete squadrons of musicians, and almost engulf the singers' voices with this thunderous kind of backing track, which was also enhanced by them being in an echo chamber. Yeah. That was a technique he favoured. Mm. So you could imagine all these kids on their pocket transistor radios just being blasted out of their chairs by this wall of sound, as they called it. Yeah. And it was a technique that was widely copied. I think most of the artists he worked with, are they known to kids today? Do my kids know who the Crystals were, the Ronettes, the Bobby Sox, the Blue Jeans, Darlene Love? I'm not sure those names.
What about this one? You never close your eyes anymore when your lips touch mine.
Something like that, yeah. The Righteous Brothers.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, didn't Cilla Black, by the way, tried to have a hit with that? And I think it so angered everybody because the Righteous Brothers version of the song was so superior to what Cilla Black had made of it that people were championing Spector's cause to get that particular recording released on this side of the Atlantic.
Yeah.
And they succeeded.
Yeah.
But I think, look, you know, we have to take into account the fact that he shot a woman dead in his chateau.
He didn't just shoot the dead. He put the gun in her mouth. And the reason he was convicted in the end was because a pathologist of enormous skill eventually found a bruise on the woman's tongue. He'd met this woman who was an out-of-work actress in a bar in Los Angeles, took her home to his 9-bedroomed home, you know, which had fences all around it. He was incredibly possessive about himself and anybody with him. And he claimed that she was licking his gun because it was some sort of sexual practice. In fact, the pathologist said in the end, no, that gun was forced into that woman's mouth and then the trigger was pulled.
Horrible.
Her name was Lana.
Lana Clarkson, they would have known that because her head would have exploded if you put a gun in somebody's mouth. But what fascinated me there, his trial, it wasn't just one trial, actually.
Yeah,
he had two trials that took 6 years
to
convict him of murder. And this was a bit of a pantomime to him. Do you remember? He used to turn up at the courtroom
in
these mad wigs. And
he
was a very eccentric person. The people I feel sorry for, his second wife, which was Ronnie Ronette, or Ronnie Spector, as she became, they adopted 3 children together.
Yeah.
And she wrote a memoir, which is one of the most shocking things I've ever read.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the name of it, but it was her story about how he imprisoned her in their home. He took away all her shoes so that she couldn't make a run for it. She couldn't go anywhere without any shoes.
Wouldn't let her go shopping.
Had this fence around the place with armed guards on it. So she was literally a prisoner.
Yeah.
But also, this couple adopted 3 children. Now, how come he ever got past the adoption authorities, this eccentric weirdo, to actually take on other people's children?
Ella, you know as well as me, most people who live in California are mad. Because it's
all
a mass.
Steady.
No, they are.
I wouldn't go as far as that.
I would. I've never met anybody who lives in California who's not mad. And they live to very strange standards. And just to let our millions of listeners on Planet Porky podcast know who we're talking about, because of course it goes back into the distant past, Phil Spector was a 5'5" musical genius. He started off in a little band of his own at school, started singing. I think he got a number one hit, actually, at the age of about 18, but then decided he preferred to adjust and provide, you know, backing tracks to music and all that. He had a talent for that, producing.
Freaky about him. I tell you something, the weirdest thing. The weirdest thing, this hit he had, which you rightly say was recorded with school friends, it was called To Know Him Is To Love Him,
which
was recorded by the Teddy Bears. But guess where he got that title for the song from. He took the inscription from his father's tombstone.
That's right. I was going to say it was on a gravestone, wasn't it? Yeah, yeah. Absolute to no.
What a
no,
freak.
No,
here we go.
Is to love, love, love him. And the original inscription was to know him is to love him, wasn't it? That's right, yeah. But absolutely fascinating.
As you just
stuff.
Sang, yeah.
Yes, and, yeah, and of course.
I mean, a very weird guy. But he co-wrote Spanish Harlem, for example, for Granny King.
Isn't that amazing?
There is
a town in Spanish Harlem.
Something like that. And did you know he played the guitar solo on The Drifters on Broadway?
No, I didn't know he could even play the guitar.
Multi-talented, multi-instrumental. So, you know, he never asked anybody
to... Broadway. Is that the one?
On Broadway, yes.
Yeah.
That's the one.
Amazing.
But I think, you know, people have been saying, should we celebrate his music because of all that he did? Well, isn't it a bit like saying, should we celebrate Gary Glitter hits or Michael Jackson hits?
Oh, definitely.
Should we divorce the art from the artist? And I think, yes, we should, because the art stands alone. In its own right, as something that somebody created.
No, I totally agree. I totally agree with that. When I was writing a book for a footballer, he actually told me, and he came from a very decent sort of East London home. Whenever, as kids, they were in the car and they were driving along, and a Michael Jackson record came on, his mother would switch it off because all the allegations had been made about Michael Jackson and the allegations towards him and children, all that kind of stuff, you know. And how can you go through your life like that? Because Michael Jackson was the king of pop, you know.
Well, basically, we wouldn't have any art, because if you delve into the private life and the background of any big name artist, you're going to find something that you unpalatable.
Isn't part of genius the fact that you're different and you're eccentric and you have different values and views in life and all that kind of stuff? And of course, Miss Jones, we can't finish this story, neither can we finish this podcast, without introducing the John Lennon tale about Phil Spector.
Go on. Yeah, well, no, you start. I mean, fascinating thing about that is that obviously Spector was obsessed with guns and he used to go into the recording studio armed. And he was threatening to shoot John all the time. And at one point, John turned around and said, "Phil, if you're going to shoot me and get it over with."
Yeah, but the problem was Spector then pulled out his gun and he actually fired a shot into the ceiling. And again, you're absolutely right. Lennon said, "So you don't want to shoot me, but please don't do that again, Phil. I need my ears, you know? It's part of what I do." So it was absolutely amazing. In the 80s, when I was in New York, Spector used to turn up in New York and he used to go to, what's that very famous restaurant uptown on 85th Street? It's named after a woman, the woman who ran it. I've forgotten her name.
Elaine's,
well done. Elaine's, that's right. Yeah, and he'd turn up there. And honestly, he would, I mean, talk about ruling the roost. He'd demand the best table. He'd demand that nobody sat on the table on the right or the left and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, look, he's a figure now well gone. He was serving time, 19 years he was serving when he died in jail.
And it's not long enough, was it?
Well, you know, he never came out. So that's true.
Yeah, do you remember that film Easy Rider, Jack Nicholson?
Yeah, of course I do. I loved it. I mean, I was about 14 when Easy Rider came out. And the only thing any 14-year-old boy on that day wanted to do was find himself a bike with a great long pair of handlebars and set off across the great country of America and find your own fate.
Yeah, well, Spector was in that film.
Was he?
He played a drug dealer in that film, yeah.
Bloody hell. And that was Peter, what's-his-namer, and...
Jane Fonda's brother.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, cool, blimey, I didn't realise that. A multi-talented man. Right, well, you know, these things are so interesting. Now, let's get to you couldn't get to a more sombre story than a murderer, could you, dying? But one closer to home, and one for which, you know, I have a great deal of feeling, and that is that Katie Price, who made her name as the model Jordan and then created really an empire around herself, didn't she, by inflating her bosoms all the time and all that. One tragic aspect of her life was that she had a son called Harvey who was terribly badly disabled. And now that he's 18, he's become uncontrollable and he's having to go into a home. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things you can say about Katie Price to condemn her for some of the behaviour during her life, but you as a mother of three children must have a real, real sort of compassionate view on this, I would assume.
Look, say what you like about Katie Price. She has cared for that boy for his entire life. He was abandoned by his father, who was a famous footballer, Dwight York. He's retired now, obviously. He must be about 49 or 50 or so now. But he turned his back on that kid. He hasn't seen him for about 13 years. He doesn't support the child financially. This kid has a rare genetic disorder. He's partially blind. He's got autism, learning and behavioural difficulties.
Because of his condition.
Because of all that. But also, his hormones have kicked in. And he's going to be in a position where he doesn't understand the physical and the emotional changes that are happening to him. She's got other children to care for as well. So what he's doing, he's going into a residential college rather than a home. A home has horrid connotations, doesn't it, really? Yeah. But I just think the father needs to step up here. He's got another son, this guy, Tiger York, who he does see. Now, it seems to me that he's discriminated against this first child of his because he's disabled.
Well, I just think his behaviour has been disgraceful. Now, how can I have a view when I've not been a parent, okay? I've never actually done it, got married and had children and brought them up. So people could say, what do you know about it? But I do know about having a sense of responsibility to those around you. And I can't believe that the media, you know, which we're part of and all that, have gone these, is it 16 or 18 years? 18 years? Is it, Harvey?
18 years.
Without, you know, more people focusing on the fact that his father probably hasn't seen him twice in the whole of his life.
It's one thing
saying, oh, well, you know, he had a very brief fling with Jordan and, you know, she had quite a lot of boyfriends in those days. That's irrelevant. The point is, the outcome of it was a human being, a little baby. And the minute that Dwight York apparently found out that there was a bit of a problem with the child, they didn't know how serious it was at start, he just disappeared faster than the speed of light and has never been back. And personally, I think that's absolutely disgusting.
I think it's because he was a famous footballer. People were in awe of him. They thought she was a bit of a sleazebag. You know, who cares what she was? As you say, she was raising a tiny child and he should have stepped up. I don't know why she didn't take him to court and get some sort of child support, but maybe she was doing pretty well at that time and her pride might have kicked in and said, if he doesn't want to take part.
There would have been all sorts of behind the scenes negotiation. You know, I don't want my image, to be fractured as a footballer and all that. Remember, he played for Manchester United. And believe it or not, Manchester United are a massive power in this land. Believe me, they have huge resources. They have millions and millions of fans around the world. You don't want to upset Manchester United. I'm not suggesting for a moment that Manchester United as a club in any way coerced with Dwight York to help him out in this situation. I'm just saying that the general feeling would be it's a big thing to upset a Manchester United footballer. I'm afraid that's the way the world works.
And in the meantime, in recent years, the tide has turned for her. She's been banned from driving. She's been made bankrupt. You know, if there's all that money and all that power behind him, then somebody step up and do something to help her. Now that she can't drive, he's going to this residential college, Harvey, that is, three hours away. How is she supposed to get there and back to see him?
No, I totally agree. It's a horrible situation, you know. Most of us sort of, you know, we weigh up our lives on a daily basis. How is it? What are we doing? All that kind of stuff. But blimey, there are some people who are suffering much, much worse than we are. Funny enough, working at TalkSport a couple of years ago, I had a drink after a show with, you know, that couple who do like an agony aunt column. Is it Dom and somebody? Dom and...
They're off the Gogglebox program.
Well done. Yeah, Dom and somebody. But they're both very nice people. And I'm sorry, I can't remember their name, but I just know them. But they're really nice people. they are. And anyway, it was the summer and I was working on TalkSport. They were working on another station. I think it was Talk Radio. But I ended up walking to the end of the road where we were working then. It wasn't the same location as we're in now. And they were sitting at a table outside the pub. And as I walked past, we, you know, exchanged pleasantries. How are you? And I said, we'd like a drink. I said, yeah, great. You know, sat down, got a bottle of wine. And it all started off very nicely. And then after a bit of wine, the lady involved told me the story about their son who is severely dyslexic, okay, and has terrible mood changes. And, you know, a bit like the Harvey thing, you never know when it's going to explode and all that kind of stuff. And she ended up in tears. And I just thought, my God, because on the surface, they've got this great career. They write these newspaper columns. They do Gogglebox. But behind all that, they had a life was a nightmare on a daily basis, not knowing how their child would react, you know.
Yeah, I think that people never know. We only know the tip of the iceberg yes. of anybody else's life. And yes. we all need to stop being so judgmental and yeah. to think, well, look, that person has a reason for the thing they've just done or said, yeah. and we don't know what that is. So we all need to stand back a little bit and not judge people by what we see.
No, I totally agree. Now, the Miss Jones, you just strike me as the sort of lady who's probably spent most of her teenage years getting stuck into Mills and Boone books, yes?
Oh, you must be joking. No, absolutely not. Mills and Boone is aimed at, well, these are sort of the kind of romantic stories you would find in a magazine like Woman's Own, except they're short book length, right. and they're more the kind of thing my mother would read.
Well, okay, so the reason I'm asking you this, of course, is because it looks like Fergie, Duchess of York. It's amazing she still carries that title, isn't it? After all the scandals that have bedeviled her through her life. But she's apparently signed up with Mills and Boone. Fergie has a deal with a romance publisher. If only she'd tell her own story in that style, writes one headline. But, I mean, they've been very successful, Mills and Boone, haven't they?
Massively so, yes. They're huge. They're not my kind of literature, I'd have to say. But look, that writer is absolutely correct. If she were to write a tell-all book about her relationship with Andy, yeah. that's the one we want to read. She's kind of anything for a dollar, isn't she, this one? She's always got debts.
Absolutely.
She's always paying something off. She has never said a bad word against Prince Andrew because right. she has wanted to stay on his right side. Well, why? Right. They're divorced. So, you know.
Yeah, but he's still a very wealthy man, despite the fact he's disgraced. He's a member of the royal family. He's still a very wealthy man. Got a huge house, hasn't he, in Great Windsor Park, where she apparently lives with him.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think there's probably more to be had from the true story of Prince Andrew by the woman who married him.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. One of these days that may well come out. That might be her final paycheck because she's
I reckon it will be. When he goes down, one we're going to read next.
I totally agree. You can see a five-parter, can't you, in you know, the Daily Mail or something like that. No, I totally agree. How she was ever allowed within 100 miles back into the royal family when, you know, you think of the scandals that bedeviled her. You know, a picture of a bald-headed American sucking her toes while she was on a sun lounger in the south of France.
Yeah. But that was pretty awful. He was doing much worse things at the time. Yeah. So that's why there wasn't such a fuss about it. Although we read all the stories about the Duke of Edinburgh has banned her. She's not allowed anywhere near Balmoral. Yeah. She's a disgrace to the royal family and all the rest. Look, there were a lot of stories they were sitting on about Andrew at that point.
Yeah. No, they were, yeah. But at one point, do you remember? I'm sure you do, because we've grown up in Fleet Street together. She actually was sitting in a room with the Sheikh Fake, you know, the guy from the News of the World.
Sheikh, even.
What did I say?
Fake.
Oh, the Sheikh Fake, yeah. All right, well the Sheikh Fake Sheikh. If you see what I mean.
Brilliant.
And she's talking to him, just for the benefit of our listeners. The fake Sheikh was a News of the World reporter. I can't remember his name.
Nazar Mahmood.
Nazar Mahmood, well done. Did he go to jail, by the way, for something?
I think he died.
Did he? I thought he went to jail.
I'm pretty
anyway.
Sure he died. If all you're right, still Matt. Alive, Nazar, let us know.
Yeah, if you're still alive, Nazar, let us know, A. And B, if you didn't go to jail, sorry about that as well. But she agrees to take £500,000 from the fake Sheikh to try and enlist Prince Andrew into, you know, some bizarre scheme to promote Saudi Arabia or something. I mean, it's absolutely bizarre.
She really is exposed as quite a sleazy one, isn't she? I mean, if I'd have been the royal family, I'd have paid her to go away.
Exactly. I totally
agree.
The trouble
is, of course, she's the mother of two of the Queen's granddaughters.
Exactly.
That is the reason to keep her sweet, I suppose.
It certainly is. Right, folks. Now, I want to tell you about the best shaving experience I've ever had. As soon as I opened the neat little Harry's box, I knew I was in business. I just love the Space Age razor with its unique hand-friendly grip and the foam. It's like a facial bubble bath. It's no wonder that Harry's was set up by two ordinary guys determined to make shaving a better experience. They were so serious, they bought their own factory in Germany, which has been making blades for 100 years. And they're now sharper than ever. They've even got an additional lubricating strip. And replacement blades are still as little as £1.75 each. Now, Harry's support great causes too by giving 1% of their global sales to non-profit organisations that provide mental health care to men in need. So give Harry's a go. Start your subscription, which includes a weighted ergonomic handle, their new 5-blade razor cartridge, rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover to protect your blades on the move. And in addition, for a limited time only, if you go direct to harrys.com/porky, you'll also receive a free travel-sized shower gel. All of this is worth £14.50, but you'll pay only £4.95. Yes, just £4.95. So, to get the comfortable shave you deserve, head to harrys.com/porky to claim a trial set for just £4.95. You'll also be supporting our podcast, Life on Planet Porky, by doing so. Head to harrys.com/porky today. Okay, folks, so here we are. Thank you very much indeed. It's Life on Planet Porky. Miss Jones, of course, in fine form, doing a bit of giggling in the first half of Planet Porky. But, I mean, you know, come on, folks, that's part of LA's attraction. Giggling again. Yeah, listen, I'm going to put a name to you, and I bet you've got 100 stories about him. Pete Waterman is 74 years of age. Is he a pal of yours?
I have met him over the years. He's Pete Waterman, OBE, actually. DJ, record producer, songwriter, Stock Aitken Waterman. I'm sure that name means nothing to young people today. But there was a time when, as a production trio, they were among the most successful of all time.
I think they had about six records in the top 20 for about a month in the sort of early 1970s. One of them would have been, or the late 60s, one of them would have been, "So, and my love grows as my rosemary knows, and nobody knows but me." They used to invent groups that didn't exist, didn't they? Called things like Edison Lighthouse, and get some guy to write a song which was so basic, it only had two chords, and then put it onto a 45 disc, and it used to go to number one, didn't it?
Are you sure about that? I thought that was rather before their time. They were very much, Stock Aitken and Waterman were very much during the 80s. It's not Edison Lighthouse. They were producing for the likes of Kylie, Rick Astley, The Bananas, Mel and Kim, Sunita, Jason Donovan. They produced that song Pass the Duchy for Musical Youth.
Pass the Duchy on the right hand side.
Or even the left-hand side.
Okay, yeah, well, right-hand, left-hand.
And then there was Samantha Fox, the Page Three girl. They did a string of hits with her. Nothing's Gonna Stop Me Now. Do you remember that one? But, I mean, Kylie and Jason were their big success story. Kylie Minogue and Jason Donovan were actors, in fact, on the Australian soap called Neighbours. And Stock Aitken and Waterman took them and turned them into pop stars. And they were massive during the 80s. Yeah. Absolutely massive. You couldn't get away from them. Yeah. And now, of course, you've got Jason Donovan on the Dancing on Ice thing on a Sunday night on telly.
Never watched it myself. Do you watch it?
Yeah, I watched it last night because I was interested to see Rebecca Vardy and how she would get on because of all the scandal with her and Wayne Rooney's wife, Colleen.
That's right.
But then there was a bit of a crisis in the house, and I'd been waiting through the entire programme, which is 2 hours long and a bit boring. Yeah. And then at the very moment when she came on, there was a domestic crisis which I had to go and deal with. And by the time I got back, she'd been and gone. But they were hugely successful. Of course, Kylie then went on to become one of the great solo artists of the entire world.
What about, talking about birthdays, what about Paul Young? Did you have a lot to do with Paul Young? He's 65.
Yeah, he's a friend of mine. I know Paul to this day. Lovely guy. He's still going, you know, he's in a band. This made me laugh so much when he told me where they got the name from for his band. They're called Los Pacaminos, and they do this sort of Tex-Mex border kind of music, you know, Mexican,
yeah.
American blues, that kind of stuff. Los Pacaminos. And I speak Spanish, you know, a bit rusty because long time since I lived
in you're right, linguist, aren't you? Speak French, speak Spanish.
Yeah,
we'll have to go on the European tour, Miss Jones. You know, take the show on tour, okay?
Definitely. But I said to him, I looked up the word, Pacaminos. Yeah. I said, I couldn't find, doesn't mean anything. He said, no, I made it up. He said it actually means pack em in, or like pack in the audience, Pacaminos. Get it? I thought that
brilliant.
Was funny.
Yeah, that's very good indeed. Ms. Jones, you've just finished writing your book, and congratulations.
Thank you.
I think you've told me you've written 320,000 words in the last 12 months, is that right?
Yes, I have. As my daughter pointed out, my youngest, Bridie, she said, Mommy, you must have written about a couple of 100,000 more than that because of all the words you throw away, which is true,
exactly.
Because, you edit a lot, and you have to.
Yeah.
You end up with... You know, you end up with a 500,000 word manuscript, actually, which nobody's going to publish.
Yeah.
So you have to bring it right down, and you've got to be selective. So self-editing is a real art, and it's taken me years to refine that.
Golly, I can't edit any stuff I do. I have to have another pair of eyes on it. I mean, you've seen this, even when I've put out tweets, you know, which are prompting our and promoting our this podcast. You keep sending
me notes. Yeah, but I'm that bitch who edits your emails.
Yeah, I know. No, you keep sending me notes saying, you know, since when was possession spelt with four S's and all this kind of stuff. You know what I mean? Just pointing out my total ignorance, Miss Jones.
But it is spelled with four S's.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's actually. All right, five S's then. You're probably right. But anyway, the reason I mention your books is, listen to this fascinating, fascinating story. J.K. Rowling is probably the most successful author in the world, isn't she?
Undoubtedly so,
yes. Exactly. A billionaire through her own efforts. So I just love this story. J.K. Rowling's literary agent, Christopher Little, who made more than £50 million from Harry Potter, takes to the grave. He died recently, sadly, this guy. Takes to the grave the details of the acrimonious fallout with the author after selling the seven titles for publication. Ms. Rowling, who earned an estimated £800 million from Potter, left Little and followed his deputy, Neil Blair, who set up his own agency in 2011. Little, who has just died, age 79, settled out of court with J.K. Rowling for a vast sum, but both signed a confidentiality pact. Do you have that sort of relationship with your literary agent, Miss Jones?
Well, I knew Christopher Little, actually. What a lovely man. He used to come in the Groucho Club for lunch. Yeah. And I was introduced to him by my previous agent. Hmm? And he was a charming man, just the kind of person you would love to spend an afternoon with, full of stories, very gentlemanly, you know, perfect manners.
Yeah.
He reminded me of Bobby Charlton in that way. He was just, you know, beautifully dressed, very clean, smelled lovely, and the sort of person you could sit with for hours and listen to their stories.
And was he worth £50 million in those days when he was sitting opposite you on a,
yes,
you know,
he
on a
was.
Table?
Yeah. And J.K. Rowling was still with him at that point.
Right.
But the story here is very sad because he took a chance on her when every publisher in the UK had turned her down.
Yeah.
He so believed in her manuscript that he kept on and kept on. And in the end, he persuaded Bloomsbury publishers to buy the manuscript. They paid so little for it. It was £2,500.
£2,500 for the manuscript of the first Harry Potter book.
Yes, that's what they paid. And it was one of those, you know, the guy who turned down the Beatles stories, because obviously there were so many of these publishers who turned J.K. Rowling down. She was Joanne Rowling in those days. And Christopher Little took a chance on her and he made her an absolute fortune. And she then turned her back on him. This was so disloyal. And she went with this guy, Neil Blair, who was another agent at Christopher Little's agency. And they go off and start their own agency so that she can get a bigger slice. And I just think that's so greedy and ruthless.
Yeah, but hang on. You've only given us really one side of the story. I mean, you're assuming that she did it for profit, but could they have fallen out on, you know, artistic issues and this sort of thing?
According to my previous agent, who knew him well,
Chris
wasn't the kind of guy to fall out with authors ever.
Right. So you think it was just a business decision to maximise her profits?
one angle to it was that Neil Blair had more experience in film and television, she wanted to develop that side of things. But this is in 2011. So this is well after all the Harry Potter films. So, you know, how much more money does she need?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. But I've got nothing but admiration for her. The reason, by the way, and you'll probably know this better than I do, in the end that she was called J.K. Rowling was, again, it was a feminist thing. They thought if they called her Joanne Rowling, it would put people off because there wasn't enough belief in the world that women could write great books.
Also, Joanna, it's an unusual name. You don't see it around all that much. There was Joanna Trollope, who was riding high at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, people might confuse the two. It's, who knows?
Well, exactly. Now, on that, and we're getting into the old, you know, the sex wars here quite well in this podcast so far, Ms. Jones. What about this story here? Young, conventionally attractive women who speak up about being sexually harassed are more likely to be believed depending on how good looking they are. Now, this is a shocking story, but it's absolutely it's absolutely true, you know. I've seen it happen in the workplace. You know, when, you know, if there's a girl there who, how can you say, I hate being, you know, rude to him and all that, but somebody who you could describe as plain, complaining about things in the office to a load of men, it's like the men are all deaf, right? But a woman who is very good looking and, you know, she's got a voluptuous figure and all that, they're not just deaf, they've got super hearing and they're all running towards her to try and help her out. You know what I mean?
Well, it's a very basic biological fact, isn't it? Men are more attracted to good looking women. Yeah. So even police officers, it indicates the level of intelligence of some of these people.
Yeah.
You know, that even they can't park their biology for half an hour to listen to a plain woman making a complaint of sexual assault.
Yes. No, I totally agree. This is a report I'm reading. It's from the University of Washington. And it says researchers found that people perceive beautiful women as more likely to be harassed and consider women who are not stereotypically good-looking to be less credible and less likely to have been a victim or to have been harmed as a result of harassment. I mean, my goodness. Do you know, I've always had a feeling, Jan, and this is not sexist at all, that there's a division of people in this world who I feel sorry for, and that is a non-good-looking woman. And I don't mean that in any sexist way at all. What I mean is that a lady who is not going to be able to sort of, you know, attract the eye of a man at an instant has an extreme disadvantage, particularly if she's going through life on her own, because, frankly, she's up against the odds at every turn, isn't she?
But isn't it a tragedy that in the 21st century,
tragedy, shocking,
we're still judging a woman by her face and her figure before we are considering what else she might have to offer? And we do not judge men like that. Nope. There are some terrifically plain, even ugly men in very high positions.
Harvey Weinstein, one of the ugliest men on earth, you know?
I met him in Cannes at the Cannes Film Festival in 2009.
Yeah.
And he was still married to the wife, you know, who divorced him when he went to prison. I can't remember her name.
Yeah.
Very, very pretty, skinny, beautifully dressed. She was a fashion designer.
Yes.
And I remember looking at them thinking, what the hell are you doing with him?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess I was judging him for the way he looked. But, you know, your immediate thought is, well, he's loaded. He's a multimillionaire. He's very powerful in Hollywood. So it's the Henry Kissinger thing, really. Henry Kissinger was very successful with the ladies.
Yes.
And he's, look at him. He's a little squirt, you know, little kind of hairy, wiry, little ugly thing.
Yeah.
But there's something about him. Yes, well, he is massively powerful, or was at the time when his sexual career was surging forwards.
No, I totally agree. You saw it in newsrooms, didn't you, all the way through your career? You know, the girl who was blonde and, you know, chatty and, you know, lively and had a nice figure, was always getting the attention of the news desk. And the other girl on the other side of the desk who was slightly overweight and her hair wasn't great and all that kind of stuff, but she was very good and very diligent and very intelligent, a bit quiet, was always kind of overlooked. You know, it is a shocking thing. And
so
me,
true.
As a member of the male race, hold my hands up and say, I think it's been a terrible thing. Now, what about your mate, Brian May? How could Brian May have possibly have lost a gift from Freddie Mercury, the man who you've just finished writing another book about. Freddie Mercury, apparently such a nice guy, he went and made a compilation of Brian May's greatest guitar riffs that they'd done together on songs and recordings in their career. And Brian May was terribly moved that Freddie had gone and taken the trouble to do this. What, you know, what greater gift could Freddie Mercury give to anybody? And Brian May's gone and lost it.
Well, I mean,
you find that funny, do you, Miss Jones? Eh? Look, very funny, isn't it?
It is funny because, come on, it's the kind of thing that happens in the music industry all the time. I have to turn around and say, well, look, poor Brian, but he's got all those guitar solos anyway because he's got them all on the officially released albums. Yeah. So it's not a great tragedy. He hasn't really lost anything. It's just that it was probably a cassette.
He's lost the gift from Freddie Mercury, the legend. The legend that is Freddie Mercury.
Come on, Freddie obviously didn't record those guitar solos onto a cassette.
No, he compiled them and put them together for him.
What I'm saying is, I'm sure Freddie wouldn't have done that by himself. He probably got his assistant, Phoebe, Peter Freestone, to do that for him. Yeah. And I'm sure Brian has said this tongue in cheek.
Well, yeah. Well, you say that, but have you ever lost something like that so valuable to you?
Touch wood, I haven't, but I read recently Gabriel Byrne's book. I can't remember what it's called now. It's a wonderful memoir. Yeah. It came out the same time as my John Lennon book. And so we did Graham Norton together.
Right.
And I read this memoir of his, Gabriel Byrne, the Irish actor. And on his deathbed, his father gave him his watch that he'd worn on his arm for Gabriel Byrne's entire lifetime. All he ever used to look at was this watch on his dad's wrist.
Right.
And he was filming in Venice with Richard Burton and getting drunk with Richard Burton every night.
Yeah, brilliant.
And he was staggering over one of those bridges over canals in Venice.
They call it canal,
Is that what they call it? Yeah. I was trying to think of the Italian word, but it went.
Canale.
Probably is canale, yeah. And all right. And he stood to look over the side of the bridge with his wrists, his arms kind of resting on the lip of the bridge.
Yeah.
And the watch slipped off and disappeared into the waters below.
God, that is careless. To have a strap or a bracelet on a watch that you can fall off your arm, that's careless, honestly.
But his father's watch, it was such a poignant moment, it almost made me cry.
I think I read that Ringo Starr lost a lot of all his memorabilia from the Beatles years in a fire in his house in California. Is that right?
Mm. Yeah, I'm sure it is. And also Brian Bennett, who's a friend of mine, he's the drummer in The Shadows.
Yeah.
He had a barn out back of his beautiful farmhouse.
Yes.
And all his drum kits, he collected drum kits from all over the years. Yeah. He had some very valuable drum kits in there, dozens and dozens of drum kits. And the barn caught fire and he lost the lot.
God, that must have been heartbreaking. My great loss was, I've moved house, I don't know, maybe 12 times, but I've also bought and sold a lot of houses that have been part of what I would call my property portfolio, okay? And I was turning them over at quite a rate in the sort of 90s. In one house, I left my program collection, my football program collection. It just simply disappeared. I think somebody who'd moved stuff into the house for me had put it in the loft and wrapped it in a black bin liner bag. It was about the size of a tea chest, you know what I mean? And they put a black plastic bag over it, and it was in the loft. And when they cleared the loft, nobody spotted it because it had a black plastic bag over it. And it took me 6 months to realize it was lost because I hadn't checked on the stuff that had come out of one house and gone into another. Never found it. And it broke my heart because some of those programs were from football matches I went to with my dad in as far back as the late 50s. And my dad's handwriting was on the program to indicate a change of player in the team lineup. And they're only made of like 8 little pages in those days. Your father would have, had football programs probably somewhere in his life from further back than that.
That's such a shame. I'm sorry for you.
Yeah.
This reminds me of a story I've obviously just been writing about.
Yeah.
Jim Hutton, who you may have heard of, he was Freddie Mercury's partner for the last 6 years of Freddie's life.
Mm-hmm.
And Freddie gave him, about a year before he died, the original handwritten lyrics of Bohemian Rhapsody,
right,
which Jim kept in a trunk. He was officially the gardener and the guy who looked after the ponds, the fish at Freddie's house. And
just in Hampstead, the house in Hampstead, was it?
No, in Kensington.
Yes.
Yeah, Earl's Court.
And where he died, yeah.
Yeah, and he kept this little trunk in his workshop. And after Freddie died, the people who lived there were all sort of ordered to leave. They had basically 12 weeks to get out and get somewhere else to live. Sure. And Jim had forgot, he, in his grief over losing Freddie, he'd forgotten about this trunk, which he left behind in his workshop. And he never got it back. And the original lyrics to Bohemian Rhapsody were in that trunk. Goodness knows what happened to them.
Yeah. Well, my programme collection, and honestly, it broke my heart. It still does break my heart when I think back on it. But I spent the next 2 or 3 years touring around programme fairs, because you have football programme fairs. You know, people would say, oh, you know, they're run by anoraks and all this kind of stuff. But there's a big interest in football programmes. I've amassed another huge collection, but they're not mine. You know what I mean? They weren't the ones that I got with my dad when I went to the football matches. Some of them are. I got some of them back. From Everton and from Chester FC when I was 5 or 6 years of age. But within the programme collection, you just talked about the lyrics to that song, were my two tickets to the 1966 FA Cup final when Everton beat Sheffield Wednesday. And I still remember to this day, they each cost 32 shillings and sixpence written on the ticket with the seat number and where we were and all that. And to lose those, you know, just broke my heart, honestly. But there you go.
Well, I can temper that a little bit. And this is a very sad story, but think about it.
Yeah.
Because it might make you feel better about your programmes.
Yeah.
My previous accountant had four children. And his youngest child, they were having a birthday party in the house for one of the other kids. Yeah. And when a grandma was coming or going, or people were leaving, you know, picking up their kids for this birthday party, the little boy, he was two, ran out into the road and was knocked down by a car. And he went into hospital. He ruptured his spleen and he was operated on, and they thought he was getting better. And the following week he died. Now that couple went on to have a couple more children, and I think they were trying to heal the wound and plug the gap by having more children. But his wife turned around and she said, you know, the more children I have, the more I miss him. I can never replace him. So there's always somebody worse off. And
yeah,
I know
I
that's
totally
not
agree.
Supposed to make you feel better, but worse to lose a living human being.
I totally agree. How pathetic is it to, you know, miss a football programme when you hear a story like that? I totally agree with you and accept what you're saying. Right. Let's just finish, Miss Jones, on something I saw, which I've talked to you about. In China, in future, if you leave food on your plate in a restaurant before you leave, you will be fined. I think.
By who? Who's going to fine you?
By the food police. They have food police in China. They have police. No.
Is it April the 1st?
No. They have police for everything in China. They have police for everything in China. Believe me. And so you're only supposed to order as much as you're going to eat. And if you leave anything and you go out, then the owner of the restaurant rings up the food police, right? And they come and they measure how much you've left, and then you get a fine through the post because they can trace you in China because everybody's traceable. I think that's a good thing, don't you?
Well, I hate waste. I hate throwing away food. We have a big thing about it in my house because when I was a child, we did have to, you know, finish what was on our plates before we could, as we used to say, get down from the table.
Yes, that's right. Absolutely. Absolutely the same.
And so you had to eat. Because our parents didn't have food to waste.
No. My mother was brought up during the Second World War when they had rationing. She got one egg a week. I mean, my mother wouldn't throw away half a strand of a piece of spaghetti when it snapped and all this kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, I do understand that. We're very strict about it in my house, but I don't really see how you can police this. And it's very simple. These Chinese people going out to restaurants just don't order as much.
Well,
if you need a bit more, have some more.
Yeah. Do you know what I used to do in my pomp, you know, in the sort of, you know, the 90s and a bit in the 80s, but in the 90s, I had loads of money. I thought I was the big guy. I'd often go to a Chinese restaurant on my own on the way home because I didn't want to cook. And I would order six dishes because I wanted a bit of everything. So, you know, I'd order a chicken curry and a vegetable curry and a cauliflower bhaji and some rice. And
then even in an Indian restaurant.
Oh, yeah, right.
You don't get
bhajis
in the Chinese.
Right. Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, I did the same in Indian restaurants as well, you know. And then, to be honest, I would only take about, you know, a quarter or a third off each dish, put on my plate, eat about half of that, then get fed up and want more drink, and then decide I didn't really want to be here anyway, and then pay for it and leave. And I'm now appalled.
So you're now arrested by the food police.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I'd have the food police following me home now, seriously. But
you take home a takeaway?
Say again?
You didn't take it home as a takeaway?
No, well, you're mad. You know, only half-bakes and poor people would take their food
absolutely
home.
Wrong. We always take Chinese food home, and it's much better the next morning.
Well, it's certainly a very American thing. That shocked me, you know, in Manhattan.
Doggy bag.
Yeah, that's right, with the doggy bag, you know. And, you know, you go out with a girl in Manhattan and you'd think, you know, how exotic she is. And, you know, this is great. She's got great blonde hair and all this. It's going to be a great night. Now, at the end of the meal, she'd ask for a doggy bag and accompany me home, you know, me arm in arm with her and her other hand carrying the doggy bag, you know.
But did you ever meet a dog who ate a curry?
Well, no, no. In fact, you know, dogs and romance have never really turned me on. Right, Miss Jones, that's
on
it.
On that note.
Yes, exactly. Thank you very much indeed for joining me this evening. All we can say to our listeners is thank you very much indeed for having tuned in. And I think it's right to say, Miss Jones, we'll be back with them again very soon, yeah?
Absolutely. See you anon.
But at one point, do you remember? I'm sure you do, because we've grown up in Fleet Street together. She actually was sitting in a room with the Shake Fake, you know, the guy from the News of the World.
Shake even.
What did I say?
Fake.
Oh, the Shake Fake, yeah. All right, well, the Shakey Fake Shake. If you see what I mean.
Brilliant.
And she's talking to him, just for the benefit of our listeners. The fake Sheikh was a News of the World reporter. I can't remember his name.
Nazir Mahmood.
Nazir Mahmood, well done. Did he go to jail, by the way, for something?
I think he died.
Did he? I thought he went to jail.
I'm pretty sure he died. If you're still alive, Nazir, let us know.
Yeah, if you're still alive, Nazir, let us know, A. And B, if he didn't go to jail, sorry about that as well. Do you know what I used to do in my pomp, you know, in the sort of, you know, the 90s and a bit in the 80s, but in the 90s, I had loads of money. I thought I was the big guy. I'd often go to a Chinese restaurant on my own on the way home because I didn't want to cook. And I would order 6 dishes because I wanted a bit of everything. So, you know, I'd order a chicken curry and a vegetable curry and a cauliflower bhaji and some rice. And then
even in an Indian restaurant.
Oh, yeah, right.
You don't get bhajis in the Chinese.
That's right, yeah, yeah. No, you're right, yeah, that's right, yeah. You know as well as me, most people who live in California are mad. Because it's a
all
mad
steady.
No, they are.
I wouldn't go as far as that.
I would. I've never met anybody who lives in California who's not mad.